So I mentioned in our opening circle that I've been spending the last year or so in the mountains in southern Oregon in mostly solitary retreat. And the land that we've been on is owned by a friend. There's three separate retreat cabins, and other yogis come up to the other cabins, but I never saw any of them. And our friend gave us the big cabin for both my partner and I to be in, but it really is just one room. And we needed our separate space to do our different practices and to be in silence. So in all of the planning and the preparation to get there, my partner, who's a good person, he said, "You can have the princess cabin." And he set up a tent, set up a canvas tent. And we researched and we thought about how is he going to stay warm during the winter. And eventually we found they make these mountaineering suits that are these big, very warm, like 800 fill snowsuit for people who are climbing Everest and things. And so we got him one, found one that was, they're very expensive. We found one that was on sale. And for his birthday, I gave him this huge Michelin man suit for the winter. And it's really how he stayed warm. He just lived in that suit in his tent, practicing, sitting and walking, just as you have been doing. But at some point, we started in November of 21. And so some months in, maybe 5 or 6 months in, it was a long winter, a lot of snow, came in, checked in with me, and he said, "You know, I could use a couple of hours in the warm cabin." And myself, I thought, oh yeah, I've had all of this lovely time with a cozy warm fire. Sure, of course, no problem. We'll trade, and I'll spend the afternoons outside with all of my generosity of spirit. So the first day rolls around, and it is snowing hard. And the suit is something to put on, and it's heavy, and it's bulky, and it's everything is wet, and there's snow all over the tent. I had some second thoughts about, do I really want to go outside and spend all this afternoon just sitting and walking in the wet and the snow? But I had promised him. And so at lunch, we did our changeover. He got the warm cabin, and I suited up. And I decided instead of sitting with the wet tent, I took a chair, a little camp chair, and I went walking up into the woods. I thought, I'm just going to sit in the snow. And there was a little bit of self-pity, maybe, but I also had the spirit of adventure. And so I went hiking up. I found a very quiet place in the woods, lots of trees, and, you know, it was a kind of snow with really fat flakes falling, just so quiet, so quiet. As I was sitting and sitting and just noticing all of the feelings, there was some fear, being cold, and also some excitement of, I'm doing it outside sitting for these hours, and sort of stayed with my eyes open because I had some anxiety about sitting out there alone, and pretty soon I saw something out of the corner of my eye, and I looked. And here's this animal kind of sauntering up. I didn't know what it was at first. And as it came closer and closer, I saw it's about the size of a small dog, spotted, big tufted ears. And it came not afraid of me at all, came right up. It was maybe from me to the back wall there. A bobcat. And it was so amazing. I had some presence of mind, and this bobcat looked, and just this bright gaze, bright green eyes, pure presence. And we looked at each other for some time, held that gaze. And there was, you know, I found myself sort of afraid, but also very present, just right there. And the same thing, this bobcat was not afraid of me. And eventually, after that moment of just bright presence, gaze, Just kept walking so cool, so slow, sauntering through the snow. Walked right on by. That was one of the biggest moments I felt in this whole time, that teaching that Bobcat taught me about mindfulness. Just that presence right there. So this is a talk about mindfulness. Nolita, in her beautiful talk on faith, she quoted Ajahn Chah saying, "Dhamma is in your heart, it's not in the forest. Just listen. Just listen to your heart." And this is what we're doing, just moment by moment here. Just listening, listening. Can we listen to what's happening inside? Sitting in the woods, it was so quiet and so still. Often when we listen like this, we let ourselves get quiet. We let ourselves really feel the silence. Amazing, wonderful creatures will come. They will come quietly to visit us. And we don't really know what that creature will be as we sit quietly, patiently here. And I think all of us, just in the last days, have had these visitors of maybe an extra moment of calm or some wonder arising. Like compassion, kindness, these beautiful qualities of the mind that come, deep clarity, deep presence, when we sit and listen. And so mindfulness, we hear this word a lot. It comes originally from the Pali term sati. We've been talking some about the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. Sati being mindfulness, patthana, four, could be, say, pastures, establishments, arenas, four fields of mindfulness. We're mindful of the body. We're mindful of Vedana, which is often translated as feeling tone, noticing pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. We're mindful of mind, of citta, the mind states and heart states. And we're mindful of phenomena, that's everything else. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha says this as a definition. He says, "Here, yogis, in regard to the body, a yogi abides contemplating the body, ardent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world." Ardent, clearly knowing, and mindful. And this is what we've been doing here. An ardency, we've been building a kind of love for the present moment, an interest, a curiosity, a clear kind of knowing of what's happening in each moment. And this sati, this remembering to come back again and again and again. And often, I know Gil uses awareness as a synonym for mindfulness. You can see how that resonates for you if awareness feels like a more accessible term, pointing to the naturalness of our knowing, the natural awareness that's already here when we relax. And you might notice how we've been pointing again and again to this fact that all we have to do is recognize that it's already happening. We're clearing the way so that sati, this awareness, can really be strong. Clearing out everything that gets in the way of that mindfulness. And then, oh, it's already here. So it's not really something to do. It's more something to allow for. Ajahn Sumedho, I think Nolita quoted this lovely British monk in the Thai forest tradition. He has this great phrase that points exactly to this momentary, moment-by-moment mindfulness. He just says, it's like this right now. Right now, it's like this. And on a day like today, have you had some of those moments? It's raining right now. Oh, right now it's sunny. Oh, right now it's windy. We can see that change. And just the mind that can know it, that can greet each changing moment. Right now it's like this. Very simple, very simple. It's so simple, it's hard. I know one of you in the fireside chat said you had a moment of deeper stillness, of deeper calm. And sometimes the mind can be like, well, okay, what's next? What do I do next? And mindfulness simply knows it. There's nothing else to do. It's just like this right now. Restlessness, sleepiness, fear, love, patience, anxiety, sorrow. Mindfulness can know all of this in the same steady, gentle, that gentle touch. Just a gentle greeting of the moment of things just as they are. And this is why we need faith, we need this trust. Trust that knowing is already happening. That we don't have to fix ourselves. We don't have to defend or brace or control. How is it? What happens when we can just trust the moment, relax and open up? And this is where all the mystery can happen. All kinds of mysterious and unexpected things can happen in this space of naturalness, this natural knowing. And so we've been talking about this list of the five faculties, this faith, energy, or courage. Mindfulness is the middle one. And then comes samadhi, or concentration, and wisdom. And mindfulness is this factor that balances. In this list, its function is to balance. And so faith needs balancing with wisdom, and energy needs balancing with samadhi. You see that beautiful geometry? It's very geometric, this list. And you've got mindfulness right there in the middle. So my teacher, Joseph Goldstein, he has this beautiful description of how this works. He says, the five spiritual faculties, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, are our greatest friends and allies on this journey of understanding. These qualities are most powerful when they're in balance. Faith needs to be balanced with wisdom so that it's not blind, so that it's not blind faith. And wisdom needs to be balanced by this trust so that it's not shallow or hypocritical. When wisdom outstrips faith, we can develop a pattern where we know something and even know it deeply from our experience, but we don't yet live it. Faith brings the quality of commitment to our understanding. So that's how faith and wisdom balance. Energy needs to be balanced with concentration. Effort will bring lucidity and clarity and energy to the mind, which concentration then balances with calmness and depth. An unbalanced effort makes us restless and scattered. And too much concentration that is not energized comes close to torpor and sleep. Mindfulness is the factor that balances all these and is therefore always beneficial. And the beauty of mindfulness is that it does this on its own. If we learn to relax, we take relaxation as our very true effort, our big training we're doing here, learning how to relax. This natural mindfulness that's here balances them all by itself. So you can hear some of how these qualities work together in this passage by Hakuin. Hakuin was an 18th century Japanese monk who is known, he's very well known for reviving the Rinzai school of Zen. So very famous, he's very poetic. And he describes, I think, some of how of these different faculties can work together. This is Hakuin, he says. A person who commits herself to the practice of Zen must be equipped with three essentials: a great root of faith, a great ball of doubt, a great tenacity of purpose. Lacking any one of them, she is like a tripod with only two legs. The great root of faith is the belief that each and every person has an essential self nature. This self nature can be fully realized. So that's that great root of faith. We believe in ourselves. We believe I too can do it. The Buddha said he wouldn't teach if it wasn't possible for each of us to realize this. And then Hakuin says, but even if you attain this belief, this great root of faith, you can't break through and penetrate to total awakening unless fundamental doubts arise. So this is interesting, right? We need these fundamental doubts to arise. They arise as we tackle the difficult to pass emotions. Have you had any of those today? The difficult to pass arisings of thoughts and worries. Even if these doubts crystallize so that you yourself become a great ball of doubt, you will still be unable to break it apart unless you constantly engage the questions with great burning tenacity of purpose. This great burning tenacity of purpose is the courage that we've heard about. But we need the doubt that rises the courage to the occasion to then penetrate through with our own wisdom. A great root of faith and a great root of doubt and a great tenacity of purpose. And so he's talking about the faith. He's talking about the energy to break through some of these insecurities we might have. And wisdom is one of these factors that also, it grows like these bulbs that are starting to shoot up in the spring. We don't even notice they're growing until a blossom arises. We can try really hard to think it through, to figure it out. Okay, I've got my faith, I've got my energy, I've got some calm, and now I'm really going to figure this problem out. But wisdom is a deeper kind of intuition, a deeper kind of knowing. Ajahn Chah talks about this, how when we have mindfulness, we set up this present moment awareness. Wisdom comes, but sometimes there's a lag time. Sometimes it takes a little while for that deep kind of intuitive understanding to come. So Ajahn Chah, great forest master, if we have constancy just to the extent of knowing our moods and knowing we're clinging to them, this is already better. Just knowing our moods. We have awareness, we know what's going on, but still we can't let go. Have you had any of that? Sure, I'm knowing this. I can know this fist holding tightly. The mind is still clinging and clinging and clinging. And so he says, we see ourselves clinging to good and bad, and we know it. We cling to good even, and we know that's still not the right practice, but we still can't let go. This is 70% of the practice already. Even if there isn't release, we know that over time, if we could let go, that would be the way. So we keep seeing equally the harmful consequences of our likes and our dislikes, of praise and blame continuously. And over time, as the mind starts seeing all of this mercurial ups and downs, all the clinging, we're pushed and pulled around, quiet kind of wisdom comes that knows, oh, letting go. Letting go is the way. It's such a surprise when the mind can release like that. It's not deliberate. Often we don't even try. The mind just, it just opens. And freedom's there in that moment. Such an important moment to notice when the mind releases on its own. Natural wisdom growing. And as the mind lets go some more, it feels really good. Have you had any of that? And that freedom, the liberation that the mind wants so badly, is onward leading. We notice again and again, oh, this is the way to let go. So some of you might know the story of the gray wolf in Yellowstone National Park. One of my favorite stories. So in the 20th century, there was a lot of hunting going on in Yellowstone. The gray wolf had a pretty bad rap. And so there's all of these hunters going out, and they killed off all of the gray wolf population in the park. And without this predator, the ecologists started studying what was happening in Yellowstone. Without the wolf, all of these other species started getting out of balance. So the elk, many, many elk started grazing, and they were overgrazing then the willow shoots and the aspen shoots and all of the different plants, which then impacted the waterways. And so the streams and the rivers changed because they didn't have those trees growing up, which impacted the beavers' habitat. So we saw all this interconnection. The beavers changed, then the songbirds and all of the grasses, the meadowlands, everything changed. It got so out of balance. All the rodents came overrunning the park. And pretty soon, even just in the period of a decade, it was pretty barren. It was overrun by rodents. All dry, barren. And so then in the 1990s, through great effort of conservationists and all these ecologists, tireless work, they made the argument to introduce the gray wolf back into the park. And so they did. They brought this predator back. And can you guess what happened then? With the wolves back, who started hunting the elk, they came back into balance. More new trees were able to grow. The waterways got healthier, beavers came back, everything started to rebalance again in this ecosystem. The birds, the grasses came back into balance. And so they named the gray wolf in Yellowstone this keystone species, because that was the key to then this permaculture, all of this other ecosystem coming. And can you see how mindfulness is the keystone species. When we reintroduce it into the ecology of our hearts, it's like we're rewilding that environment. Our hearts have been overrun and barren by the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. We see them running rampant in the world. We have these forces in our hearts. And sometimes we can feel kind of dry and barren inside, don't we? But with mindfulness, it's like we don't even have to reintroduce all these other species. They come back on their own. Compassion can come, and energy and courage comes. Samadhi grows. So rewilding the heart, that's what we're doing. Can you feel that happening even a little bit? Even in the middle of all the sleepiness and the restlessness and the fears and the anxieties, there's little shoots, little plants growing up, starting to rewild. So maybe little moments of freedom and happiness growing, contentment. So mindfulness has all these qualities, and one I want to touch on is that it's a great protector. And some I've been speaking to, talking about fear. Sometimes when we come here, we uncover this depth of fear, this real sense of being vulnerable. We're vulnerable in a human body, and it's scary, isn't it? Life can be so tenuous, so tender, scary. But mindfulness acts as a protector. And so this sutta, it's called the Hawk and Quail Sutta. I'll read you the story. The Buddha says, "Once a hawk swooped down and seized a quail. And then while the quail was being carried off by the hawk, it lamented. The quail says, 'Oh, we're so unlucky of so little merit. We strayed out of our ancestral domain. We strayed out of our own resort into the domain of others. And if I had stayed in my resort today, in my ancestral domain, the hawk wouldn't have been able to come get me. This hawk wouldn't have stood a chance.' And the hawk said to the quail, 'But what is your own resort? What is your ancestral domain?' And the quail replies, 'Oh, it's that freshly plowed field over there with all the clods of soil.' And so the hawk was very confident. And the hawk said, 'Okay, I'll let you go back to that plowed field with all the clods of soil.' He really thought he could come back and get that quail. So he did. He released the quail into the field. And so the quail is very happy. He says, 'Having climbed up on a large clod, he stood there and addressed the hawk, "Come get me now, hawk." And so this hawk, very confident of its own strength, folded up its wings and suddenly swooped down on the quail. But when the quail knew that hawk has come close, it slipped inside that clod, and the hawk shattered its breast right on the spot." And so the Buddha says, so it is when one strays outside of one's own resort into the domain of others, we're in danger. Therefore, don't stray outside your ancestral domain. And what is your ancestral domain? It is the four establishments of mindfulness. What four? Here in regard to the body, to Vedana, to the mind, and to phenomena. This is our ancestral domain. Mindfulness of the four foundations, the four fields. Can you sense how that's a kind of healthy boundary? We stay in our lane. And we take responsibility for what we can take responsibility for, right? This mind, this heart, this body, this field of the senses, right here. And then we let go of all the rest. We can't control other people. We can't control circumstances, situations. But we can really take care of this heart and mind. How is it responding? Can it respond in a healthy way? When I lived in Hawaii, I learned this phrase some of you might know. Sometimes they'll say, "Oh, that's not your kuleana." Kuleana means ancestral domain, sort of. It means your responsibility. And it's this beautiful teaching about how we can take care of just our plot of land. And the whole rest, not your kuleana. You can let that go. And you can notice as you're sitting and walking and moving about, do we give authority to things outside of our ancestral domain? Do we give authority to others' opinions? Do we give authority to situations that are outside of our control and we struggle against them? Do you give authority to your own spinning thoughts? And this is a training again and again. Where do we find our own ancestral domain? Ajahn Suchito, Nolita's beloved teacher, he says, you don't give enough authority to your heart, your citta. Citta is the Pali word for heart or mind. Can we give our authority back to the citta? Can we feel this as our ancestral domain? Our responsibility. It kind of makes us sit up straighter. And it also is a great freedom because we don't have to take responsibility for anybody else. Just this. Tulku Orgyen Rinpoche, who is one of the great Dzogchen masters, he's in the lineage of Tibetan masters that I study with, he said this, there's one thing we always need, and that is the great watchman of mindfulness. Mindfulness is the guard who is always on the lookout for when we get carried away, swept down the river. Mindfulness is a protector. It keeps us safe. And so one of you came in one of our practice discussions, had this great insight. One of you here said to me, you know, I realized in a moment of mindfulness, I realized all the other past moments of mind wandering, and this millions of times that my mind has wandered, they don't matter anymore. And all of those future moments where my mind will probably wander, those don't matter either. Because right here is a moment of mindfulness. Can you see that? The Buddha often said that. It's almost a direct quote, actually, from one of the Buddha's teachings. Let go of the past. It's already done. Don't worry about the future. It's yet to come. Mindfulness, the body, always here in the present. And so we've been weaving in this theme of impermanence as we talk about these five faculties. Have you seen how mindfulness is also impermanent? Sometimes it's really here and strong, and other times we might be lost. And also, interesting to watch, there's a spectrum of mindfulness, of presence. Sometimes mindfulness can feel so acute, clear, right there, subtle. See all these little subtle moments, subtle layers passing quickly. Other moments, we might have some mindfulness. Even if you think you're not mindful, if you think you spent a lot of your sit just lost completely in your thoughts and your daydreams, if you go back, you remember, okay, I'm mindful now. If you go back and you can remember what you were just thinking, that means there was already some mindfulness there. Not completely lost. Same thing with your dreams. Sometimes on retreat, we have very vivid, clear dreams. When we wake up and remember them, it means there was even some mindfulness in your dreams. You can recall them. So there's a whole spectrum, and what we're doing here is just slowly, slowly coming more and more into that very clear, very present, very gathered, kind of cohesive mindfulness. It remembers a lot. It can know a lot at once. So Joseph often says, well, are you more or less mindful? It's kind of floating through your day. Or can we be wholehearted, wholeheartedly mindful? That's that courage. Can I really stand up in my raft and see the whole terrain here? Thoughts included, emotions included. Mindfulness can know it all with that kind of clarity. And so Gil this morning was talking about how one insight we notice in practice is that each moment has two things. It has an object, something that we're knowing, and it has the knowing of it, the awareness. And moment by moment, those two are arising simultaneously. So like now, you might be listening to the sound of my voice and you might know that you're listening. Same, same. You know that you're seeing. Seeing is happening, knowing it. And even that can be felt in a very impermanent kind of way. Mindfulness is also inconstant. It's coming and going and coming and going, coming and going, moment by moment by moment. Sometimes we feel that as a kind of discrete experience. Knowing hearing, knowing seeing, knowing the body, knowing a thought. Other times it can feel more like a river, more like the flow. The moments are connected, and so mindfulness can know all of it in this more connected, continuous kind of way. Both are good. Both are impermanent. Notice, how is it showing up? So mindfulness is a protector, it's momentary, it's also always here in the body. This reminder that Gil offered, the body's always in the present moment. It's why it's such a good home ground. And so another sutta, this is very evocative of this present body awareness that we're developing here. There's a story the Buddha tells, a great troop of dancers, very skilled, very refined dancers, come to the town. They're dancing in the marketplace. And the assignment is, this is us, we're like the people who are watching the dancers. We're kind of following them through the streets, watching this brilliancy, this great display of skill, talent, beauty. And our assignment, what we have a big bowl of oil balanced on our head. And behind us is a swordsman. And if we, in our walking, following the dancers, watching the dancers in this display, if even a drop of oil spills out of the bowl on our head, the swordsman will chop off our head. That's a pretty evocative image, right? So the Buddha says, be like that. Can you be in your body so composed, so clearly aware of every move that that bowl stays balanced perfectly on your head, even with the whole display of the world dancing before you? The display of your own mind, all of the fantasies and the plans and the intensities of emotion. Can you stay with this composure in the body, so balanced, so graceful, that not a drop of oil spills? And can you do it as if your life depended on it? Not a pushing, overly kind of effort, but a ferocity to it, an ardency. Yes, I care about this. I care about each moment. I want to fully be here for it. What can I learn? And can you see the world as that display of dancers? It gets even more beautiful when we're composed and steady in the dance. And so one of the beauties, this is kind of like a magic power that mindfulness has. The Buddha talked about it in terms of when we can experiment. We're going to talk some about mindfulness of thinking soon, and a lot of questions have come around this. When we are mindful of different kinds of thought, we start to learn about how the mind can incline towards more well-being and more happiness. And in this way, it's important to stay mindful of all kinds of thinking. Thoughts of jealousy, thoughts of resentment, anger, injustice, thoughts of gratitude, thoughts of wonder and generosity and kindness? And can we meet with mindfulness each of these different experiences, these different emotions, these mind states, and notice the impact they have on the body? Can we notice how we feel when we're caught in these different emotions? And the more mindful we are, the more aware, the more we learn, oh, if I incline more towards this way, these healthy, beneficial, balanced kinds of emotions and mind states, oh, there's more ease. There's less suffering. There's more coherence. There's more alignment with my values. And if I'm caught in jealousy, resentment, anger, we have to let that play itself out. But if I really get caught in it, if I let it run wild, there's more suffering there, more stuckness, kind of feeds itself. And so mindfulness, as we start to notice all these different kinds of thoughts, we start to incline more and more towards the healthy end of things. Sometimes it's hard to trust. That's why we need all the trust and faith. Because it does happen. We have to trust that over time this inclines, the mind will find its way towards freedom. It doesn't happen overnight. But we had this really excellent question. Here we are all talking about how to be with ourselves and how to grow these qualities. But what about injustice? What about oppression and all of the just very real cruelty, the oppression, the troubles of the world? How do we face that with this practice? And I don't have the answers about how to respond skillfully. There's all kinds of different ways. But I think this right effort that Gil was talking about, I think there's a key there. Because as we're applying our effort with mindfulness, more and more we start to see, oh, when the mind can respond to these situations of injustice with a kind of stability and equanimity, with a deep kind of caring and engagement, with compassion, instead of the hindrances, instead of getting caught in ill will and sensory desire and dullness just checking out, bypassing. If I can show up with these qualities that feel very strong, very clear, patience, resolve, generosity, a deep compassion for humankind, then the skillful response can grow out of those qualities, the healthy ecosystem of the heart-mind that can see all of that with a deep kind of poise. And we can't anticipate what actions or speech will come out of it, but we can trust that. We can trust the skillful response to be more immediate, more spontaneous, and more creative because it's coming from a healthy kind of heart that's been growing all of these healthy native species in it. And the more this happens, the more our trust grows. They have a healthy feedback cycle. Each one grows and grows. So you might even, as you're listening, this is a really wonderful practice to do, especially when we feel like we're losing heart, maybe losing some courage. Reflect back on your own goodness. All the moments you've had here of some freedom and some insight. Or in your life, maybe moments when you've acted out of that kind of alignment with your own truth. When you were seeing your values and you spoke through them, spoke truth to power, or acted in a way that was beneficial, maybe surprising. Reflecting on our own goodness really can fuel this trust, this energy and courage to keep going with our mindfulness practice. There's so much goodness here. And we overlook it because we have negativity bias and we see all the ways we tumble and fall down sometimes. But wow, sitting here in the seat, it is such an honor because we get to see all of your goodness, all of your beauty, your wisdom. It's already here. So we have to remember, that's another kind of mindfulness, is to help ourselves remember our own goodness. That beautiful poem by Galway Kinnell that St. Francis and the Sow, I think, that says that we flower from within of self-blessing. reminding ourselves of our own goodness. And the body imprints with these memories, and there's more energy then, inspiration. So we reflect on our own sila, our own goodness, and also reflect on the goodness of others. That's why it's so fun to be with this wonderful team, these hearts that have really been growing so much goodness. I find a lot of inspiration in my Dharma friendships. We can see the goodness of others and see how the practice is working in them, and we are buoyed up to continue. Oh, okay, there's something here. Maybe I can do it too. So one time I was on retreat at the Forest Refuge, which is a long-term retreat center in Barrie, Massachusetts, and Joseph was teaching. And I had a thing with the doors. I think Gil spoke to these doors, how closing your rooms, your doors to your rooms, can be a whole practice in itself and a whole relationship with the handle. Same thing at the Forest Refuge. It's very quiet there. And we had some of these doors that, if you weren't careful, they would slam. And so that was my very, maybe a little uptight, this very careful practice of making sure the doors were just so quietly closed. Every time I would very much pause and do this. And one time, Joseph, I didn't know, he was kind of standing behind me. I was like quietly closing the door outside. And then I saw he was there, a little self-conscious, like, oh, he was waiting to go out, spending all this time at the door. But then later on in his Dharma talk that night, he had talked about how he had had a moment of more or less mindful. And then he saw a yogi really carefully closing the door. And it helped him remember, oh, I'm here. I can close the door carefully too. And I had this moment of hearing that and being like, oh my goodness, Joseph was inspired by my care with the door. Felt a little bit of pride. But we do that, and you can trust this. All of your sincerity here, all of the ways that you're mindful through the food line and mindful with your steps, this is a support for the community. And sometimes we can feel self-conscious and we try to get all tight and do it perfectly. But we can relax and know just the simple awareness of what's happening. Our body in space is a kind of support. That's why we take refuge in the Sangha. Because we can't do it alone, and we keep seeing again and again, okay, if this person is doing it, maybe I can too. So the last quality of mindfulness I want to touch on is this kind of deep receptivity. We've been talking a lot about this effortless effort. So easeful. And sure, we need courage and we need to apply our energy. But in the end, the Buddha describes his mindfulness like this. He says, in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cow herd would guard the cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since they need only be mindful that the cows are there. So the cow herd doesn't need to herd anymore. The crops have been taken in, the cows are peacefully grazing, and this cow herd can rest at ease at the root of a tree, just watching the field. And this is what the Buddha said. He said, so too, there's no need for me to go out and herd all of these mind states and the dynamic thoughts and the unwieldy emotions. It's only the need to be mindful that those states are there. Tireless energy was then aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified. So it's this effortless effort that then begets energy. Can we rest back in a very deep, trusting, kind of courageous way? We don't naturally relax often in our daily lives. We're not trained to relax. So can we take this on and really see mindfulness as a training in relaxing? My Tibetan teachers call this non-meditation. Not distracted, but not meditating either. Not like pushing or doing anything special. Non-meditation is this very natural present moment awareness that doesn't need anything else. Doesn't need a special posture. It doesn't need a special experience. So simple. Sometimes it's boring. It's already here. Sogni Rinpoche, one of my favorite Tibetan teachers, he calls this non-meditation, he calls it essence love. I love when he says that. What is essence love? Kind of a brilliant way of describing this okayness. Gil this morning was saying, can we with our emotions just rest and say, it's okay. I'm okay. That's essence love. It's okay. It's a very quiet voice sometimes, and sometimes in all the spin of things and all drama, you know, inside, and we're arguing with it, we're like, actually, I'm not really okay. This is very intense. And this quiet kind of essence love just says, no, I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm okay. Deep trust and courage. Okay, so Ajahn Chah says this about this mind. In truth, it isn't really anything. It's just a phenomenon. Within itself, it's already peaceful. That the mind is not peaceful these days is because it follows moods. Sense impressions come in and trick it into happiness, suffering, gladness and sorrow. But the mind's true nature is none of those things. That gladness or sadness is not the mind, only a mood coming to deceive us. The untrained mind gets lost and follows these things. It forgets itself. Then we think it is we who are upset or at ease or whatever. But really this mind of ours is already unmoving and very peaceful. Our practice is simply to see the original mind. So we must train the mind to know those sense impressions and not get lost in them. To make it peaceful. Just this is the aim of all this difficult practice we put ourselves through. Our practice is simply to see the original mind that's already unmoving and peaceful. And so to conclude, mindfulness balances the five faculties. It's natural, and it's the keystone species that brings all of the other beautiful qualities of heart and mind with it. It serves as a protector and a guardian. It's found in present moment awareness of the body. Its function is to remember, and it's found by relaxing. And so we can settle back, just finding yourself again in this present moment, finding your body. And we let all of the thoughts and the emotions, the sensations just flow through like a river. Trusting the naturalness of your own innate wakefulness. And I'll conclude with the words of Hakuin again, this wonderful Japanese monk. Buddha means one who is awakened. Once you have awakened, your own mind is itself Buddha. By seeking outside yourself for a Buddha invested with form and other things, you are proclaiming yourself a foolish person. It's like a person who wants to catch a fish. They must start by looking in the water, because fish live in the water and are not found apart from it. If a person wants to find Buddha, they must look into their own mind, because it is there and nowhere else that Buddha exists. If a person wants to find Buddha, they must look into their own heart, because it is there and nowhere else that Buddha exists. Thank you for your kind attention.